You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out.
Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
Want some more?
Well, good evening, also good afternoon, and welcome to Mouthful. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Thanks for both being here, and if you are listening on the radio, for tuning in. This is the fourth or fifth time Mouthful has come to the Sebastopol Farmers Market, and it's always a special joy for me because this is my hometown market, the one I spend every Sunday at. So it's really a pleasure. And I also have to thank the weather gods. It's not blisteringly hot, as I think it was the last time you were here, Alice.
Sure.
I think we had one person assigned to umbrella duty. So thanks very much, and welcome back to Mouthful.
It's my pleasure.
Now, we just want to check. Can everybody hear Alice okay? Okay. Now, you're very involved in slow food, one of the initial people involved in slow food in the United States. And since we're celebrating the Gravenstein apple today, I wanted you to explain what the arc of ingredients, what that means, and what it means for an ingredient to be taken onto the arc.
Does everybody know what slow food is? Yes.
It looks like we have a well-informed crowd.
This is very good. But I really came to slow food, maybe it's been 10 years or so now, when I first met Carlo Petrini, who was the founder, and when he started talking about the idea of bringing people to the table by making tasty food to put on that table, I just said, well, that's exactly what we've been trying to do at Chez Panisse since the beginning. And I just felt like Chez Panisse had always been a slow food restaurant. And then he talked about the arc of taste. And it's a beautiful idea that you are trying to preserve these beautiful ingredients that have gone out of style and have been thrown aside because they are not shippable or that they're just irregular shapes and sizes, all the things that don't conform to the rules of fast food and globalization of food. So this is what this Gravenstein apple represents. It's this tasty variety that got left behind. And this is a kind of a revival meeting today. And we've put it in the ark of taste. And it's like Noah's Ark. We're going to keep it, and along with many, many other ingredients that are almost to extinction in this country.
I think, have they put the Olympia oyster?
Yes.
In the Ark.
Yeah.
I think there's just three or four ingredients from the United States. So the Ark includes ingredients from all over the globe.
And I hope they have those Blenheim apricots in there.
That would be nice. Yes. And we have here, Alice, if you would like to have a little toast to the Gravenstein. This is freshly pressed Gravenstein apple juice.
Delicious. Here.
One of the things I love about the Gravenstein is, in a way, it's the wisest apple of the year because it ripens before we have the fall storage apples. It ripens, it lasts about 3 weeks, and then the other apples start to come in, and the Gravenstein is gone. So it's one of those ephemeral, fleeting pleasures. What are there things that you like to do with it?
Well, we make tarts, obviously, at the restaurant with it. But one thing that I like is to make a kind of fruit jelly out of it, where you just cook it down and cook it down. It's like until it becomes a paste.
Almost like quince paste.
A quince paste, just exactly like quince paste. But we make it with Gravenstein apples and serve it with cheese.
That sounds really
and
good.
The idea that it comes early and you have this and then you go on to the Macintoshes and the other tastes is something that allows that season to expand, and you get to taste each individual apple flavor as you go along. And that's something that once you get involved with seasonality, that you begin to appreciate that subtlety. And it's what gives the season of, no matter what it is, whether it's strawberries or whether it's plums or peaches, you start eating the first peaches and the varieties that come, and it leads up to the magnificent ones that sort of come in September, and then you have a last chance peach.
Right. And then you dream about peaches until the next year.
And then you're done with peaches, and you don't want to talk about peaches until the next year. But it's getting out of that sort of mediocre taste of a particular fruit or vegetable all year long. So when the good stuff comes, you're bored. You don't want it. And this way, you're anticipating it. And when it begins to happen, and this is the harbinger of things to come with the apples, the Gravenstein, and you just say, oh, that's just fantastic. And, of course, the juice is the essence.
The juice is so, it's not too sweet. It's just so beautiful. Before we leave the subject of Gravenstein, and we will return to it, I want to say that with today's show, we're launching a new feature at Mouthful, and you'll be able to go to krcb.org each week and get a Mouthful recipe of the week. So what we'll be featuring this time is thin-crusted apple tart. So by tomorrow morning, you will be able to get that recipe of the week. Very recently, Alice, you started the Victory Garden in anticipation of Slow Food Nation coming up in about a month. Could you tell us about the Victory Garden in San Francisco?
Well, I've always been talking about a vegetable garden on the White House lawn. I've been doing that since about 1992. And what better way to talk about nourishment and stewardship than to have a garden there representing that. It's what we need to have happen in the spirit of Thomas Jefferson, just a magnificent garden that feeds the residents within and sets the example
sets the tone. Mm-hmm.
For all of us. And to go back, and what could be a better way to eat the best tasting, most affordable food than to have your own garden or to be part of a community garden? And so when there was the possibility of Slow Food setting up a garden right there at the Civic Center in San Francisco, I said, oh, yes, this is what we need. And I never imagined that we would find an artist to help to organize that. And when you see this garden, I think you will find it surprising, both in its its unusual configuration and the varieties of things there, but really it feels like it was always meant to be there. You see the dome of the city hall right behind and the corn growing up, and you say, this is right. And people come in now, and there are sort of the curators mm-hmm. of this garden exhibit are there to talk about how to grow it, how to prepare the soil. They're leading sort of tours of this garden, and it's very exciting to see what's going to happen at Slow Food Nation, how we're going to harvest it, and where it's all going to go.
Yeah, it's going to be my next question. What's going to happen with the harvest?
Well, it's all going to be to good use. That's all I know, and that everything that's in the garden can be recycled.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the grass was removed in squares and given to people all around the city.
Oh, that's great.
And it's a huge piece of property. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be difficult, I think, to go back to what it was. So we're hoping that we can...
That they'll make it permanent?
Put enough pressure on and that we can really make it something that is a permanent expression of the mayor's green city.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been working for a long time through the Chez Panisse Foundation on school gardens. How is that going?
Well, again, we, I think, have a great opportunity with this new president that we're going to have to really put a program in the schools that can feed every child real food. Real food. We need a program like the one that Kennedy put in way back when, that insisted that every kid take physical education.
Yes, that you got.
Remember
that? Somewhere I have a certificate that I passed President Kennedy's physical fitness requirements.
Well, you know, they built gymnasiums and hired teachers and bought equipment and built tracks, and every kid in this country, from kindergarten all the way through 12th grade, had to take physical education. And they got graded for it.
Oh, didn't
they? They got graded for it. And so what I'm imagining is they would take a course in, I dare say, eco-gastronomy and edible education. They would begin this in kindergarten, and the lab would be the garden on the schoolyard, and the other lab would be the kitchen, and the kids would be fed in, and the whole curriculum would be integrated around gastronomy and ecology. And so that's the grand plan, the grand vision. And it's not impossible to imagine that we could start thinking of spending the money up front instead of out back.
Absolutely.
And we have such a pressure from the health issues, the environmental issues, the cultural breakdown. Everything is at a crisis point. And so we might have this opportunity to come in with a visionary president and have somebody who sets the example, has the beautiful rhetoric to inspire our nation.
Because right now it seems that sort of thing is percolating up from individuals. And I do want to say we have a wonderful opportunity today. Worth Our Weight Culinary Apprenticeship Program is here with a little booth. They're usually at the Santa Rosa Farmers Market, but in celebration of the Gravenstein apple, they are here today. Evelyn Cheatham has just done marvelous things. She works with underserved youth who are mm-hmm. transitioning out of, say, foster care, or kids from various parts of Sonoma County who haven't had the same opportunities, and she teaches them everything about eating and cooking and running a restaurant, and it's just a marvelous program. And somewhere, Evelyn is here somewhere in the crowd, probably hiding now because I mentioned her name, but what she does is one of the examples of, I think, what could be done all over the country. And if you get a chance, when the interview is over, go take a look at Evelyn's booth and say hi to the people over there.
This is a program. We've been doing the Edible Schoolyard program, which you may have heard about. You probably all know about it. But it is in a middle school in Berkeley, and there are 1,000 kids that are involved in it.
Is this the Martin Luther King
this
Middle School?
This is the Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School. And kids have an experience in the garden. They come out with their various teachers, whether it be math or science or English or art. They may be doing drawings of the plants in the garden, or maybe they're measuring beds for the math class. And then they have an experience in the kitchen. So they're maybe studying Egyptian art, and they're making that food. History or even drama, they could be doing improvisational cooking in the kitchen, which is a beautiful idea. But there's not a class and not an age where this couldn't be brought together. You could be counting beans instead of buttons. And the most remarkable, the two truths of this experiment have been: when kids grow it and they cook it, they all want to eat it. That's one. And the second one is that they really like an interactive education. They don't think of it as school. And so they're so happy to be in the garden, touching and smelling, that they learn these lessons very easily. And this opens up their minds, this sensory stimulation that just happens naturally when you're working in the garden or you're working in the kitchen or you're sitting at the table and eating food together.
Mm-hmm. I find that kids seem to really make that connection with the idea of organics at the same time, too. They get that idea that what feeds the plants is pure and good, and that they should be thinking the same way about what makes them grow. I've watched that with my grandson.
Yeah. It doesn't... You don't have to teach that, really. It just sort of that information comes in osmosis. You're working in the garden and you're working in the compost. They all know what compost is. You know, after a couple of weeks, they all know how to plant the seeds. They know the care that's involved in that. And it's as if they've had this longing. They're hungry. But they're not just hungry for the food. They're hungry for people to care about them, and they're hungry to be connected to nature and the cycle. They're hungry to be at the table and be engaged in that whole ritual. It's something that has brought people together since the beginning of time. And nearly 85% of the people in this country don't eat one meal with their families for all kinds of reasons. People are living the fast food life, even if they're eating slow food.
What was that percent again?
Well, I've heard that it's as high as 85%.
That's just
astonishing. But when you go and you ask kids at school, that at least those are the figures that work at a middle school in Berkeley, California. So I suspect that what's happening elsewhere is even more extreme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's in Berkeley in Northern California.
And you know, when they're out there sort of grazing for themselves, they're digesting a whole other set of values.
Yeah.
And they're learning that food should be cheap and that, you know, advertising confers value. They're learning that there's infinite resources, always more where that came from. They're learning that standardization is more important than quality. They're learning, you know, the cooking is drudgery.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to do that? And that is what's really changing the world. And so we need to have a program in the school, a comprehensive program that doesn't miss one child. And that's the only place that we can do it. And if we fed every child in school, and this is the part that's pretty important to communicate, is that there are how many? 20% of the population is in school right now. And if the schools had a criteria for buying food that was local and sustainable, we could change farming and ranching and dairy making overnight. Really, overnight to meet the demand. And in Berkeley, there are 10,000 kids in school. And Chez Panisse only serves 500 a day. And we support two farms entirely and buy from another 75.
Change the demand of the schools.
You can do the math, and you just think about it, and then you have schools all across the country that are trying to buy food that's good, clean, and fair.
Mm-hmm. Now, you started Chez Panisse in 1971, am I right?
That's true.
Okay. And my point in making that is, when you started, food and what was available to both restaurateurs and to people just shopping was so different. And I wonder if you could offer a little bit of perspective on what that sort of arc of transformation has been.
Well, I know this is an overused example. You've probably heard me say this 20 times, but we used to buy Kentucky Wonder Beans. I wanted the food like the food I'd eaten in France, and I was on that quest. And so I would get a whole case of Kentucky Wonder Beans and look for the little tiny ones that I thought were the haricot vert. And I would take them out of the bottom of the box and throw everything else away. and now, of course, we have discovered that that's a special fraud. About year five, I learned this. And we started getting them from the Chino Ranch down in Southern California. And I just thought, well, this is a little miracle. They're all the same size already, and we never throw away hardly even a little tail of a bean now. But that's what's happened. I mean, it has gone from, three or four varieties of things to really hundreds. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful... It's been a beautiful journey to discover that the best tasting food comes from the people who are taking care of the land, the people who plant these varietals that are in exactly the right place, in exactly the right little microclimate. They know how to take care of that particular variety, and then they bring it to us. And we get to eat it in, immediately, without ever putting the raspberries in the refrigerator. I mean, that is something very, very special. And it's the way that I ate when I was in France. I just didn't know how complicated that was going to be to find in this country. But that's how I had to go to the market twice a day in France, because people brought in things in the afternoon that were different than the ones in the morning, and I wanted the fresher ones, so I would go to the market in the afternoon.
Uh-huh. How have you seen your customers change over the years? Have they... Are they getting more sophisticated?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think that we've all been educated together, and we have people, in fact, they come for the Gravenstein apple tart. They want the pink lady. They know the names of the fruits and the vegetables. Mm-hmm. They know who the farmers are. They know who Bob Kennard is. They know, who Mas Masamoto is. They're looking on the menus in that way and being very particular about it. So that's been very, very gratifying.
Thank you. should remind you that you are listening to Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. Today it is a Mouthful at the Market. You can hear it tonight on KRCB. Maybe you're listening tonight on KRCB from 7 to 8. My guest, Alice Waters, here at the Sebastopol Farmers Market, where we are celebrating the Gravenstein apple, slow food responsible for this. One of the things that is happening in Sebastopol, I should tell you about, Alice, is a number of restaurants throughout Sonoma County are putting special Gravenstein dishes on their menus throughout the Gravenstein season. We have Patisserie Angelica. It's a little short trip to Paris without having to get on a plane. Duck Club, Dry Creek Kitchen, Toad in the Hole. Even our British pub is putting Gravenstein apples on the menu. Willie's Wine Bar. So I think they have done a really wonderful job of bringing the community together to celebrate just one ingredient. So bravo to all the restaurants who are doing that. We also today have three Gravenstein apple farmers featured at the market. We have Stan and Susan Devoto, Lee Walker, and Paula and Kendra Colling. So there's plenty of good Gravensteins to take home and eat right away. Don't let them go soft. Are you going to be involved, or I should say, in what way are you going to be involved in the upcoming Slow Food Nation?
Yeah, I'm very involved in that gathering of people from across the country. I hope we're getting an enormous response. And I hope that it really turns out to be a gathering that's greater than the sum of the parts, that we can really express in one kind of delicious voice that we want to change in our food system. And so such a loud voice that they hear this in Washington, mm-hmm. and that this becomes part of the dialogue, the conversation, that it's not just about a food bill, but it's really about how we're going to change the way that we grow food and we distribute food, mm-hmm. and the way we eat food.
Mm-hmm. I should say it's taking place August 29th, 30th, and September 1st.
Exactly, and it's at Fort Mason and at the Civic Center in San Francisco, and there's a website to give you all the information about it. But I'm doing something that really interests me. I'm putting together something called the Green Kitchen. And I'm finding chefs from around the country, very well-known people like Thomas Keller and Charlie Trotter, as well as Deborah Madison and Scott Peacock and many others, who are going to come in and do a short cooking demonstration using 2, 3, 4 ingredients, something incredibly basic, affordable, and delicious, something that they can talk about with great authority and might help us to learn it very quickly. That once you see them demonstrated, it's part of your gastronomic memory. Mm-hmm. And we're going to record these, put them on YouTube, and put them out in the world. And so we're trying to gather as many chefs as we can, even people who aren't in the restaurant business, mm-hmm. but people who have a following, who could excite people about cooking, who are particularly good at working with their hands and talking with the public. So that's going to be the Green Kitchen ongoing all day on Saturday and Sunday.
Oh, that sounds great. And that addresses one of the issues I struggle with in the contemporary world of food, in that with the popularity of the TV Food Network and really complicated cooking, I think people have gotten intimidated and they've forgotten that the best food is from the garden, but the best food is made in the home kitchen and it's not difficult.
It's really true. Well, this little program is going to be the opposite of the Food Channel. There's going to be no cooking equipment, just a mortar and a pestle. A little burner, a cutting board, and a knife. So this is the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. Not really meant to be, engaging and inviting, because once you know how to poach an egg and make a little vinaigrette, you shop at the farmer's market too. It's so easy to cook a meal for family and friends. Cook a meal in 10 minutes. That's it's something I do often. I make a pasta or I make some vegetables that it just, we need to demystify the whole cooking process and sort of come back to our senses, learn how to evaluate ingredients, learn how to follow the seasons. And it's kind of what I tried to do in with the latest book that I've written, The Art of Simple Food, is to get back to the principles behind the cooking, which are really about how you buy it and how you cook it simply and how you share it.
Mm-hmm. What was it like growing up in your house? What were meals like when you were a little girl?
My mother wasn't a good cook. That was the problem.
That's one thing we have in common.
And I don't think we had any garlic in the house now that I think back on it. No garlic. But my early food memories are from my mother canning rhubarb and apples, making applesauce from the garden.
Mm-hmm.
They had a big victory garden during the war, and I came in on the last end of it, but they kept that victory garden their whole life. A little patch, no matter where they moved, they had a little garden that at least had tomatoes and peppers and corn. And tomatoes and peppers and corn still are the love, my loves, food. And so that made an impression, but sadly, my mother was so busy with four children that she didn't do anything except defrost the succotash
open the cans.
Open the cans. This was the 50s, and we lived in New Jersey. It was the cuisine of the day, and no muss, no fuss.
Yeah.
And sadly, because we don't have deep gastronomic roots in this country, we allowed all of these fast food producers to come in and really do some indoctrination.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We believed it.
Yeah, we did. We believed it.
We believed that cooking was drudgery. It was the most relaxing and pleasurable thing I can do.
Now, did you cook as a child? Were you drawn to the kitchen?
I was always sort of looking to see whether I could find something up in those cabinets. But my mother was interested in our health, and so we didn't have cookies around or any sweets for that matter, and I had a whole wheat bread. And
That was pretty remarkable to have whole wheat bread then.
Well, she had that, but it was when you believed that all the bacon you could feed a child was a very good thing. So we used to just have brown bread with lots of butter and just two or three slices of bacon. Four. That was breakfast. And I still like those bacon sandwiches.
That sounds really good.
And to see how this has turned around so completely in 25, in my lifetime.
Yeah.
You're listening to Mouthful on KRCB Santa Rosa. Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit more about this idea of the Victory Garden and the modern-day Victory Garden, because it's an idea that really intrigues me. And I might remember wrong, but did one of the presidential candidates say he or she would put in a vegetable garden if they were in the White House? Or did I have a dream? It seems like I heard that fairly recently.
I think that was a dream.
Okay. It could have been. I dream about food on a regular basis.
Well, I know that Hillary Clinton planted some tomatoes on the roof of the White House. But
she did?
Yes, she did. She did plant tomatoes on the roof of the White House, but that's as far as we got.
Okay. Well, it seems to me that the idea of the Victory Garden, and for those of you who don't know, who are really young and didn't hear about Victory Gardens, and I don't know if I have them completely accurately, but it was during, I think, both World War I, and I remember that from watching Upstairs, Downstairs, and World War II. You grew a lot of things because things were simply not available because so many of the country's resources were going to the war effort. Well, it seems to me now, with gas at the price that it is, that you could take that concept of Victory Garden and transform it to using fewer resources, including trucking of the food from a long distance, and even driving to the store if you live a ways away and you want a BLT, for example. You go out into your garden and get the tomatoes. But it just seems like with the struggle we're having with energy, that you could just they might need to be renamed instead of Victory Garden. You know, maybe we need to think of no oil garden or something. But it seems like
a slow food garden.
Slow food garden. Just seems like an idea worth pursuing right now.
Oh, it's such an important idea, and I'm hopeful that this will be one of the big messages that comes from Slow Food Nation, that we all need to go back and plan a garden, whether it's a community garden, whether it's gardens in the schools, or whether it's gardens in our backyard. And there's a number of books that have come out. I don't have the names right on the top of my head, but about how people have gone about doing this around the country in all different climates.
Oh, there have been a number of books that came out last year about that.
Just about that. And I've been involved with a garden at Yale University for the last 7 years, and they have 300 varieties of fruits and vegetables planted in that garden, and things that people said would never grow on the East Coast, things like artichokes. They have a particular variety of tomato that is has a tougher skin, so it's resistant when it rains and during the summer. They have all kinds of herbs that have extended the seasons, and cardoons, if you can imagine, just things. It's all the Italian sort of bitter lettuces of the endives and the radicchios and all of those planted in the garden. And then they have a greenhouse during the winter, which we have to begin to think about. Greenhousing, whether it gets too hot or whether it gets too cold, we're going to have to think about the affordable greenhousing and the possibilities of seeds being transferred and really enriching the agricultural possibilities of places around the country is something so exciting to me. I'm working on a project in New Orleans. We have an edible schoolyard in New Orleans. And the beautiful part about it is that they have brought to the project all of the plants. I mean, they're thinking back to the history of gastronomy in that region. And you cannot imagine how rich it was. I mean, they have everything that they need, and they just have to begin to replant, and they can be completely self-sufficient in and around the city of New Orleans, really. It's fantastic.
Time always flies on Mouthful. Before this hour is over, what do you think of the concept of and the practice of gleaning. Have you seen the movie The Gleaners and I? And, you know, all of the orchards that have fallen by the wayside, including here in Sebastopol, apple orchards, the fruit falling to the ground. Do you see a revival of the idea of gleaning?
Absolutely. I mean, it's such a great thing is to invite people into your backyard to pick the fruit that you don't have an opportunity to mm-hmm. pick, or you don't have enough people to feed.
Mm-hmm.
There's someone who is living in Berkeley who has started this a project in and around San Francisco and Oakland to put the call out to anybody who would like his or her backyard harvested. And she goes, she picks the fruit, and her friends preserve it, pickle it, make it mm-hmm. into jam, and she's going to bring it to Slow Food Nation. I'm just thinking right now to the rabbit seeds that are falling from my tree and that I have not picked up yet. If anybody'd like to come and harvest.
And we have two women here in Sonoma County who started a project called Frutas Gratis. I think they started it 2 or 3 years ago. And they started in conjunction with a show about soil at the Sonoma Museum. And at 5 locations near downtown, they piled up fruit. And the fruit had an edible stamp, stamped with edible ink that just said Frutas Gratis, free fruit. And they started doing that all over Sonoma County. And they started taking phone calls for people who had quince, Meyer lemons. There are Meyer lemons all over West County that, if you can believe it, go unpicked. So they've been doing that project for 2 or 3 years. And at first, people were afraid. It's like, what do you mean? That's free? I can pick up that apple? It's really okay? And I think it's an idea that's starting to spread. I think it's a wonderful way just to connect with other humans.
Well, we have been foraging since the early days of Chez Panisse, really, along the roadsides and picking wild fennel. We pick plum blossoms and make plum blossom ice cream. We put the call out for anybody who had backyard excess radishes, watercress, and we used to do exchanges with meals at the restaurant. So I truly believe in this foraging. I think everybody's lawn should be planted in purslane. it grows like a weed. It's so drought resistant. It's so nutritious, and it makes a great little salad. Grows quickly. Nettles have become a kind of mainstay mm-hmm. at Chez Panisse. We make nettle another really nutritious weed that. It's just all over Bob Kennard's garden, and now he's selling it to us, selling us nettles, and we make these beautiful pizzas where we pile it all up on top of the pizza, drizzle it with oil, and then as it bakes, it just all wilts on top, and then we shave some pecorino on the top, little garlic someplace in there. But it's become the most popular pizza at the restaurant, and this, it's just opening up one's mind to all of these possibilities. I look at these landscape and wonder why every tree isn't an edible something. Like in Seville, they have the oranges that line the streets, mm-hmm. and you can harvest them and make marmalade. And
well, we've got Daryl Cordy doing that with his Capital Marmalade. He years ago, Daryl approached the state because they're in front of the Capitol building in Sacramento, where all these orange trees. So Daryl now harvests those oranges and sells through Cordy Brothers up in Sacramento his Capital Marmalade. We need more of that.
Well, there's a guy, the president of Caltech Discovery. He's a Frenchman. And he discovered the olive trees that are all around the campus. And he organized the harvesting of the olives, and they press them now. They make their own olive oil, and they sell it. This Caltech olive oil, and he's in the after they have their exams, he goes into the kitchen, brings the students, and they make omelets together and use the olive oil. It's such a such an obvious and beautiful way to connect with the community.
Obvious is a good word for it, and abundant. Well, Alice, thank you so much for taking time, and thank you so much for all the really great work that you do. You know, a lot of people who launched well-known restaurants didn't go in this direction. You know, maybe they went to Las Vegas and licensed their name and, you know, sat at the head of chains. And you've done so... I mean, I love your work with Schoolyards and just your passion for eating real and for everyone eating real food. It's a constant inspiration to me, and I think everyone who's touched by your work.
Well,
we appreciate it.
Thank you so much. But it feeds me. Feeds me when I see the kids all sitting at a table and eating together and passing it around and having a civilized conversation. And it's a delicious way to live my life. And I mean, aside from the fact that I'm talking instead of cooking. I wish I were cooking. I wish I were cooking again. And I will.
Yes, maybe we all cooked something today. Should tell you, coming up next weekend, it is the Gravenstein Apple Fair at Rego Park, one of the sweetest little fairs in all of California, maybe in the entire country. For information about Slow Food Nation, you want to go to slowfoodnation.org. Again, that is coming up August 29th, 30th, and September 1st. We're going to... break away now for Mouthful's weekly book review. Meet me back here next week when we'll be talking more about slow food. We'll have, I'm going to blank on his name. I can see his face. But we have a wonderful chef. It's not Scott Aronson, is it? Paul. Paul Aronson. He's a warm, articulate, wonderful chef. He had a very sweet little place right on the edge of the Tenderloin, Ballon, a seafood restaurant a number of years ago. And now he's heading up the Starlight Dinner that's going on. So he'll be on Mouthful next week. So meet me back here then for Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour on KRCB. And thanks very much to the live audience.
Stark, author of Heirloom, Notes from an Accidental Tomato Farmer, was once a writer who dreamed of being a farmer. Now he's a farmer who writes in his spare time. Stark probably isn't doing much writing this month because it's the height of tomato season, that blessed time of year when it's possible to get great-tasting tomatoes in all shapes and colors, yellow, orange, red, purple, brown, green, all of them sweet and heavy in the hand. Tomatoes have come a long way from their original wild ancestor, a tiny yellow fruit grown by the Aztecs in Central America, who called it zitomatel, meaning plump little thing with a navel. It's easy to see why a writer would be attracted to growing tomatoes. They're one of the most sensual fruits around, all warm flesh and juice, and they have the most poetic names: Brandywine, Cherokee Purples, Green Zebra, Marble Stripe, and those are just the more common heirloom varieties. Ever had a Nebraska wedding tomato, or a potentate, or my favorite, a Radiator Charlie mortgage lifter? Tomato plants are promiscuous little buggers, mating and crossbreeding with whatever cousin is planted nearby, so Stark often makes up his own names for any misbegotten progeny. That's a bowling pin tomato, he'll tell buyers at his stand at New York's Green Market, or with a perfectly straight face. That's a huckleberry honk. Stark's descriptions of the daily work of farming and the dramas of the farmer's market are lively, amusing, and richly detailed. He tells of placating New York City garbage truck drivers with handfuls of just-picked sugar snap peas while he double parks and dashes into restaurants with bulging boxes of produce. Talking about his early success with heirloom varieties, he writes, "I could not help but notice how these tomatoes responded to me in ways that women, bosses, and literary editors never had." Stark quickly discovers, of course, that a man cannot make a living on tomatoes alone. He expands his offerings to include heirloom varieties of chilies, peas, rare greens, and anything else he could coax from the soil of his Pennsylvania farmstead. During rare slow periods, he turned to foraging for money, gathering wild berries, including elderberry flowers, for New York's most discriminating chefs. Growing food without the benefit of pesticides or herbicides is no easy task. At first, he battled weeds by hand, then adopted a live-and-let-live attitude towards them. He was less sanguine about the predations of groundhogs, one of which he eventually caught and drowned in his pond, a story that brought an avalanche of hate mail from animal rights-minded readers when it originally appeared in Gourmet magazine. If you've had fantasies of quitting your day job and becoming a nouveau vegetable farmer, check out Tim Stark's Heirloom before you buy the farm. It may not change your mind, but it will give you a clear-eyed account of what happens when a genteel urban fantasy turns into a gritty reality down on the farm. This is Laura Hager for Mouthful.
Support for Mouthful on KRCB comes from KRCB radio members and from the Sebastopol Farmers Market, now open in the downtown Sebastopol Plaza every Sunday from 10 to 1:30 with organic, sustainable, locally produced fruits, vegetables, meats, and cheeses, plus breakfast, lunch, and local musicians. Support also comes from Peter Lowell's Cafe in Sebastopol, offering breakfast, lunch, and dinner in the rustic Italian tradition, featuring seasonally sourced organic produce. Serving brunch Saturday and Sunday, Peter Lowell's Cafe online at peterlowells.com. Support also comes from NetBooks, complete business management software for companies up to 50 people, including wineries and food producers. Information available at netbooks.com or by phone at 86-NETBOOKS.
Listen to what the preacher says. To the Lord that praises me. It's time for dinner now, let's go. We got some beans and some flip cornbread. Listen to what the preacher says. To the Lord that praises me. It's time for dinner now, let's go.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.
Dinner,